The Iron Game Chalk Talk podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors: EliteForm.com and IgnitionAPG.com. And now, the Iron Game Chalk Talk podcast. Welcome to Iron Game Chalk Talk with your host, Ron McKeefery.
Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go! Let's go! Everything you got!
On this podcast, hear Coach McKeefery's straight talk about training, featuring the top strength and conditioning professionals from around the world. And now, here's your host, Ron McKeefery.
Hey guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Ron McKeefery, and this is episode number 70. Iron Game Chalk Talk is a weekly podcast where I bring you experts in the field to talk shop each week. If you haven't already done so, make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes or YouTube, or join the mailing list at ronmckeefery.com so that you can stay up to date with the latest episodes and anything else that I have going on. This week, excited to have a friend of mine on the show. Sean Mishka is a movement specialist. He's the Pro Performance Director at Explosive Edge up in Minnesota. Works a lot with professional players, NFL players. We've worked with a lot of the same guys, and we've spoken at a lot of clinics together, and really, really bright guy, does some awesome things. So I'm excited to hear you talk. We talk a little bit about the idea of having a movement specialist on strength and conditioning staffs and what that would look like. We talk about, you know, the warm-up and, you know, some things along those lines where, you know, maybe, you know, some things that we could do better or some things that to think about, and just, you know, what a typical training session looks like for him. So I know you're going to get a lot out of it. Before we do, we want to make sure we recognize our sponsors, IgnitionAPG.com and EliteForm.com. EliteForm is a sports science company based in Nebraska, and, you know, you've heard me talk about them on the show quite a bit. I think Skip and the guys out there are fantastic, fantastic people, and they're doing it the right way. They're putting out products that are great resources for strength coaches. And so their paperless system, being able to push workouts, the Power Tracker Lite, being able to use it like a Tendo, measure velocity and things along those lines at the rack. And then the Strength Planner, obviously being able to design programs and make that process easier, is huge. And anytime you can give time back to the strength coach, you know that I'm a fan of that. So make sure to check out EliteForm.com. And see what they got going on. Lastly, if you like Iron Game Chalk Talk, you'll definitely like strength-ondemand.com. Strength On Demand is an online archive of strength and conditioning clinic presentations that myself and Rob Taylor put together. Working actually right now on being able to add a lot more content to this, and we've made it where it's a lifetime membership. It's not an annual thing or a monthly thing anymore. It's a lifetime membership. And so, for $97, you have 50 plus presentations right now and growing. Like I said, we're about to dump quite a bit more content into it. So check that out. You'll be able to access it from anywhere that you have a Wi-Fi connection, and be able to learn on the go is always great for, busy strength coaches. So I want to get to the show. Sit back and enjoy this. Make sure you take lots of notes. And I'll see you on the other side. All right, guys, real excited to have a friend of mine on the show today. Sean Mishka is the Pro Performance Director at Explosive Edge Athletics up in Minnesota. And we've known each other for probably, what, about 4 or 5 years now?
Yeah, about that.
You know, he's trained guys that I've worked with and vice versa. And he's one of the top movement coaches in the country. And so we wanted to have him on the show talk a little bit about that, but brother, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day and spending it with us.
Hey, it's my pleasure, my friend. I know it's been a long time coming, and we can finally make this happen. Who knew it was going to happen in the middle of the week of a football season, but right. At least we're making it a reality by now.
That's right, man. Well, hey, John, go into a little bit your journey, man. Obviously with bodybuilding and how you've gotten to the point that you're at right now.
Yeah, no doubt. It's kind of a different journey, even though it's going to be somewhat similar in many ways to many of the professionals that you've had on Iron Game Chalk Talk. But, I started at a very early age, 8, 9, 10 years old. At that time, my mom owned a nutrition store. My brother was a world-ranked powerlifter at the time. So it was a natural progression to me to get into training, and the training performance right off the bat. You know, I wasn't just dabbling in things. By the time I was 12, 13, 14 years old, people can say what they want about stunting growth and things of that nature. And granted, I'm only 5'6" and a half, so maybe I shouldn't talk too much. But yet at the same time, you know, when I was in my early teens, I was competing against adult men in powerlifting contests. I was super strong all the way throughout the time from middle school all the way to high school. I got to the point where I was, you know, really taking hold with some of the training principles and ideas, and I was fascinated by some of those things. I then got into bodybuilding because I realized that powerlifting was a little too easy for me, just simply because I had the stature to be real good at it, but I've always wanted to just be the best at whatever it is that I did. So I actually ended up making the transfer to bodybuilding, won a number of state level titles from the time I was 19 to the time I was 24, kind of around the Midwest states, ended up competing at the national level. During that time, got my undergrad at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, actually in health promotion, with an emphasis in strength and conditioning. And at the time, as Division III school, they didn't have a strength and conditioning coach, so I volunteered to take a lot of the athletes, do those things on my own time, because I knew I wanted to get into strength and conditioning. I knew that bodybuilding wasn't really a way to make money over the long haul, even though I was making it at the time. And I was one of the rare few, but to really make money in bodybuilding, obviously you got to be one of the best, and there's some freaks of nature out there.
Right.
And it was going to take a lot and a lot of demand on my body in order to do so. You know, I had gotten to the point in my bodybuilding career where I was at 5'6" and a half in the off season, I was 280 pounds, and it just wasn't a comfortable lifestyle. You know, I'm kind of like waddling everywhere. I'm like a weeble, you know, I wobble, but I don't fall down. And I realized I didn't want to do that long haul, you know, but I did realize that I had a real knack for changing people's performance and a passion for that. So I just continued to go down that path. I started training a lot of athletes at the Division III level, had a number of All-Americans, had a number of Players of the Year, National Players of the Year, and Conference Players of the Year in Wisconsin Athletic Conference. And it was something that I just gravitated to. So even when I was bodybuilding, happened to fall in the right place at the right time, get a short stint at the Chicago Bears in 03-04. Dick Duran's last year was my only year there. I was under Russ Reeder, who was a longtime strength and conditioning coach in the National Football League. And then got left there and came over, had a bodybuilding sponsorship. That was short-lived. You know, again, my body just kind of didn't hold up. Tore a glute, tore a quadricep, and realized that I should probably get into this full time, and that this was performance enhancement. So I started this facility and this business then about 8 years ago now. We're right across the road for the Minnesota Vikings headquarters. So, you know, it just happened to fall in the right place at the right time. Football has always been my passion. The movement that happens in football and the performance that it takes to be a phenomenal, masterful football player was something that I just gravitated to. The mentality, the idea, that which is happening. Fascinated by the whole thing. And now, obviously, I'm very humbled and grateful to be able to say that a good number of NFL players entrust me with their physical preparation throughout the entire year. And, you know, it's just, I always tell people, you know, I'm trying to live the dream here. I think I kind of am. So I dig it right now. And until I lose that passion, I'm just going to continue to do that each and every day.
Well, that's great, man. That's a great story. And obviously, you found your niche through that process in movement, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that's something that you and I have talked about constantly at conferences. And, you know, recently on your blog, you posted about, you know, the pitch for a movement coach for an NFL program or for any program for that matter. What do you see, you know, because we're always talking on the show about opportunities for strength coaches, you mm-hmm. know. And, you know, obviously this is an aspect of where the field is headed, I believe. But what do you see a movement coach as their responsibilities? What's their objective? You know, what are they trying to accomplish?
Yeah, and I know at first glance it sounds like a very foreign, awkward idea, a very awkward niche. But here's what I saw, Coach, is that my very first NFL player was back in 2007, 2008. I won't say him by name, but he's still with me to this day. Was a tight end in the league, has made it to a Pro Bowl now at this point, actually stuck with me through something that I kind of found through experimentation, kind of my own stupidity, if you will. You know, this guy had already been in the league for 3 years at that point, comes to me, I looked at his testing. You know, I went through all of our quantitative testing with him, the 40, the pro agility, the vertical jump, the horizontal jump. I tested his clean, his squat, all those fun things that we all do. And I laid out this plan, thought we were going to go on this huge direction towards just changing the NFL together. And lo and behold, granted, he had increased his vertical by 9 inches. He had increased his broad jump by 15. He had decreased his 40 time by a quarter of a second. Same thing with the pro agility. He had added muscle, lost fat, all these things. Sent him over to training camp. And I went out to watch him, and I looked at him when he was out there, and I'm like, this guy did not change at all from the guy that I saw the previous year when I watched his film. And I thought to myself, Sean, how could I have messed this up?
Sure.
Because we had done all these things from a quantitative general motor ability performance indicator, but I didn't really change the movement in the exact ways that it needed to be, at least for that athlete who resides at that higher level of mastery and qualification to begin with. And so I kind of came to that Robert Frost moment, as I call it, where there's a fork here and a fork there, and I can choose to go down one road or the other. I could continue to do the same things because I knew that he was satisfied with increasing his vertical and increasing his broad jump and decreasing his 40 and those things. But what I came to the realization is that I didn't change anything really where it mattered and where it counted.
Right.
And when push comes to shove at the end of the day, all of my athletes, whether they're NFL players, all of your athletes of Division I football players, no matter what sport we have and no matter what athlete, the main thing they're coming to us and entrusting us with is changing their sport performance, whatever it is at that time that needs to be changed in order to make that occur. At the lower levels of mastery and qualification, I realize that things such as general motor abilities, strength, base strength, speed, conditioning, flexibility, stamina, those types of things – then in, you know, end up enhancing the movement. But as an athlete moves up in levels of qualification, we got to get more specific and specialized with those movements that they produce on the field on Sunday or on Saturday in your instance, or maybe on a Friday night or even a weekday.
Right.
Whatever it is that they perform, that's what becomes our driving force. And at the center of that sport performance, then, I found, is the movement and the movement taking place. So I started to view myself, And some strength and conditioning coaches sometimes take offense to this, but I started to view myself, rather than being a strength and conditioning professional, to making it a little bit more broad to being a movement coach or a movement specialist, to the point where my NFL guys introduce me that way to other NFL players. Hey, this is my movement coach, or this is my, you know, movement performance specialist, or whatever it is. They just started using that. And it came to that I came to that realization then that when I started to look at these NFL teams, we entrust our coaches and our staff with way too many duties and responsibilities. You know better than I do that we put all these duties and tasks on these coaches, but no one is really in charge of the specific movement. You have the position coaches who are very good with strategies and tactics. You have strength and conditioning professionals who are getting guys prepared in a very short window based on the CBA.
Right.
To do things from a general motor ability standpoint. You have coordinators and such, you have athletic trainers, but no one is really handling the optimization of the movement and the strategies of the movement so we can bridge all those things together. There's no conduit between it. So we leave that player to chance. And so what we find is that our athletes who are at the highest levels, our all pros, our pro bowlers, those types of guys, usually haven't done so necessarily because they specialized and got the most optimal movement patterns. They've done so because they're the best compensators.
Right.
And even those best compensators end up getting injured with so-called non-contact injuries, ACLs, MCLs, the Achilles that are going across the country and across the league right now.
Right.
And so what I thought to myself is that when those guys come to me, you know, too, that when you're talking about an NFL player, you can tweak and tune a little bit. And that tunage goes a long way with that higher level nervous system.
Right.
And all of a sudden I'm like, well, if every team had someone who was entrusted and in charge with this, think about how much different the NFL would be. If we were trying to specialize guys, every single player on the field, all 53 on that given roster at that time, we're trying to optimize their movement per their position demands and per who they are as an individual. Because that's really what we do in track and field. We do that in the 100 or the high jump or the shot put or whatever it is.
Right.
But in team sports, we often don't look at it that way. But if we did and took more of a technical movement model towards it, I believe that with that higher level of qualification athlete, even some that are at the, you know, year 3 and year 4 and year 5 guys that you have, likely would see a huge improvement right where it counts, which is on the field.
Sure. You know, with that, though, you know, just being devil's advocate, the opposite would be, you know, the argument would be made, okay, this guy has 21 years or 23 years of forming these compensation patterns or these bad habits or these poor technical movement patterns. How do you change that in an 8-week program or even, you know, a 12-month program?
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing that, and that's a great devil's advocate point, and I appreciate it, because we often see or think that, you know, granted, all these things aren't going to change immediately.
Right.
But if we bite off one, two, or three things that are having major impact and impairment in dysfunction and compensation out in the movement, all of a sudden Pandora's box kind of opens up for us. Now, how do we go about changing that is the real question and really the rub at hand. And the one that you brought up is that what I have found out is, I tell my NFL guys this all the time, the guys who first sit in my chair right across the desk from me, and they say, okay, well, what exactly are you going to do for me in the training session? And I tell them right off the bat, it's more than just the training session.
Right.
What I want to do is I want to change their habits that then lead to behaviors, that then lead to patterns out on the field. And if I can change their small habits, how they're sitting down in the chair in front of me, how they're walking away from me, how they're standing in posture, these types of things do start to carry over. Okay, so what I found is that everything in life is movement, of course, and everything in life affects your movement. So I might have that guy for 10, 12, 14 hours in a week. But there's 168 hours in that week.
That's right.
So if I can impact them in the hours that they're away from me or when they're out in the field and I'm there monitoring them and I'm there seeing them and say, listen, let's take better control of this small habit. Maybe we're not dorsiflexing and we're getting in a bad compensational pattern to where then our foot is striking out in front of our line of force and we're putting ourselves in a compensational pattern for a possible hamstring pull. Or something, or we're just wasting and leaking energy. Maybe something like that, that they can consciously and cognizantly think about and get more competent with as we go along.
Right.
If you start taking small bits of it, all of a sudden, before you know it, it starts showing itself and the chaos arises, which is the National Football League or MAC football or whatever it is. Sure. And so I think it's a great point and a great question. But what I realized with those higher levels of nervous system type athletes, now some people will also play the devil's advocate and say, hey, Sean, I work with high schoolers. Like that, how many high-end nervous systems do we have?
Right.
Obviously, there it's a little different, but they're in those levels of qualification and levels of preparedness. There's other bigger fish to fry as well, such as strength and
right.
conditioning and base speed. But in the athletes that we're talking about that are going to contribute to your wins and losses, as well as in my wins and losses as far as the athlete's personal characteristics and movement mastery, those things can really be addressed in those top-level performers without a doubt.
Absolutely.
If, you know the NFL, you got 1,696 Ferraris out there.
That's right.
If you take it to a Chevy mechanic, we got problems. If you're a Ferrari mechanic, watch out.
No doubt. What qualifies a person to be a movement coach then? I mean, obviously, you know, with strength and conditioning, you've got so many aspects, especially at the college level where you're dealing with strength, power, speed, balance, coordination, kinesthetic awareness, and skill acquisition, and all these different things. How do you become an expert in movement?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a fantastic question as well, especially because most of the time, those individuals who looked at as movement specialists or movement professionals, and not taking anything away from what our industry has done in that regards, but usually it's in non-organic environments.
Mm-hmm.
It's the functional movement screen where the athlete is moving very slowly or in more static fashions and things
right.
that are not going to really necessarily correlate or translate immediately to compensations that are taking place on the field or the performance on the field. So I think that's a great question. What I had to do when I started coming to this realization in 07 and 08 with that player that I mentioned before is that I started to dissect the movement taking place when and where it mattered, which is out on the field. And I had to start thinking like a football coach, but from a strength and conditioning standpoint. So I wanted to understand what was happening, why it was happening, in order to understand how I was going to go about impacting it in the right ways. So for me, when I look at a movement coach or a movement specialist, it's somebody who really takes sport biomechanics and sport kinesiology to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that biomechanics, we've all had our biomechanics and kinesiology and functional anatomy courses and things like that, but the body doesn't behave that neatly and nicely when it's out on the field and we got 11 men chasing us ready to tackle us.
Right.
So we got to think about all of those things. Kinesiology, or the kinesiological pattern, is really how the body behaves biomechanically when we're under chaos and when the body has to, or the brain has to, cognitively, and then the senses have to perceptually determine how it is we have to position ourselves spatially and temporally in space in order to overcome or throw out the best possible movement strategy. So those individuals who then would be looked at as movement coaches and specialists do have to do a great deal of study in regards to the sport biomechanics rather than those nice and neat and pre-programmed fashions that we often look at. Mm-hmm. I often tell my people, you know, people say, well, you must be, because you're a movement coach, you must be highly into the functional movement screen. And now I think like Greg Cook and some of those individuals are brilliant individuals who I have adapted much of my material from. But I've had to adapt it and then apply it out onto the football field, out onto the gridiron. And that's a whole different animal, I'll tell you, my friend.
Right.
Because once you start looking at that and you realize, okay, if we look at the displayed characteristics, we're looking at the balance between mobility and stability as it takes place in the field. We're looking at force absorption versus force exertion, center of gravity and base of support. These types of things show themselves, and they show themselves not when our athlete is with us in the neat environment where they don't have chaos. But when chaos arises, we need to be able to depict how could that athlete have better overcome the stimulus of that stress and of that chaos. And what can we do in our drilling as well as then in our motor potential, so our strength and conditioning measures, in order to translate into that technical movement mastery? How can we bridge those together? And it takes a rare individual to be able to read that, and I'm not just trying to toot my own horn, but I watch more film than any football coach I've ever met in my entire life. Yesterday I watched about 16 hours of film. Yesterday was a Monday, so I had to watch 7 different games from the previous Sunday, the day before.
Right.
Just to be able to determine, did the things that I do in the summer with each one of those guys on each one of those teams go to the right places, and do we show it? And if not, why not? Were there things in the environment that they weren't able to overcome? So once you learn to dissect it that way, it takes somebody with a great deal of passion, but it takes somebody with an eye to be able to go frame by frame, okay, this guy is doing this, he should have done that. Here's what's impacting it, and we got to put ourselves out there on a limb in order to do that in many cases too, because like you already mentioned, there's a lot that you guys as a whole, the strength and conditioning coach, are entrusted with. And I got to be a strength and conditioning coach on many days, but then everything always still centers on that NFL player's movement. So I know that was kind of a long-winded answer, but I think we have people in the strength and conditioning profession who are most definitely qualified to do so, if they were entrusted and were able to then be able to have that and be that conduit between the position coach and the actual strength and conditioning measures.
Well, that hits it right on the head, and that's what, you know, in a lot of specs, and if you look across the board at the programs that are doing it the right way, per se, mm-hmm. you know, there's such a hand-in-hand type of relationship between the strength coach and the sport coaches, because I mean, that's ultimately what it is. It's seeing things and being able to apply the science to the practice of the sport, you know, and I think that's such great feedback when it's given, when it comes from a coach, you know, I think that's what you're doing such a great job of, is bridging that gap between, you know, not just the strength part of it, but the movement on the field with the athletes and the coach, and being able to put it in both, in terminology that they both understand.
Yeah, and that was one thing that I really had to get accustomed to doing, you know, because I was so used to strength and conditioning or sports science and exercise science speak. It's much, much different to talk to a football coach or a position coach. So I started bringing position coaches in here. I had some big name position coaches come in, and what they all realize, and they come to the conclusion after a 1 or 2 or 3 hour meeting of watching me take one of their players through, and they said, you know, we were doing everything from a strategic and tactical standpoint, but if we can take that strategy and that tactic, and then you're able to put it in a movement technique that takes the greatest advantage of that athlete's potential,
right,
who they are anthropometrically, biomechanically, what they're set up to do, what types of strength and weaknesses they might have to enhance their strengths or detract from their weaknesses, we know that most players – you know, we might have two players that have been in the league for 3 years. They play the same position, but one is 6'2" and the other one is 5'8". They probably don't move the same.
Right.
So they probably shouldn't even be positioned the same in their stance all the way then to the ways that they execute strategy. And the more position coaches that hear this idea and this objective, they're like, why hasn't this been done in the past? And the answer that I have is I don't know the answer to right. that. I wish there would have been. But that's what I'm trying to do. And I know that there's a number of individuals at some places that, like you said, are doing it right and trying to take the most hands-on approach that are really investigating those displayed characteristics that athlete is showing when, where, and how it counts, which, of course, again, is on the field.
You mentioned, compensation patterns that have led to a lot of these injuries that you've mentioned. You know, what are the most common compensation patterns you're seeing with elite athletes, and how can, the strength coach at the college level, high school level, maybe make some more generalized programming to address those?
I think that's a fantastic question, and I'm glad that you asked it. There's a number of different things that I see with my NFL guys, or the guys with the higher level of qualification and mastery, those guys going from college to the NFL or in the NFL. First off, we have a huge epidemic in regards to certain non-contact injuries. ACLs, obviously, but those are becoming more and more common and easier to recover from. But things that take a lot of energy storage, such as the tendons. I already mentioned the Achilles tendon once, and we've seen a rash of those now across the NFL in the last number of weeks over the first 2 weeks of the season.
Yeah.
When we look at the energy storage in the determination of how much we're going to involve the muscular components versus the tendinous components versus then the nervous system. So stretch shortening cycle activities obviously need to come to the forefront of most high school conditioning professionals in my mind.
Sure.
We see the need and the demand for eccentric rate of force absorption. Even those athletes that are at the higher level of qualification, out of those 1,696 that play on Sundays, most of them are still lacking eccentric force absorption capabilities. I always kid to my guys is, over the last number of years, we've had guys interviewed for like Sports Illustrated or ESPN and those types of things. And they say, well, what are you doing in your training? And they always mention doing altitude drops or isometrics and things of that nature that maybe they were doing in the Soviet Union back in the days. And we see it being done in some programs, but probably not as much as we see the emphasis on force exertion.
Right.
And so some of those things lead to then the actual motor potential characteristics that then show themselves in the movement. So guys have a problem when they're going through eccentric or force absorption deceleration patterns when they have to move dynamically. I see it in my running backs, in my running backs at the NFL level. If all I do is get them more accustomed to having a lower center of gravity, playing with a lower pad level, as the football coach would say, and widening in a base of support and being able to do things from different stances, whether it's staggered or lunge or not having those types of things, we start to see that show up immediately out on the field. And so we see things, that maybe are coached in a too concentrically dominated fashion as guys are coming up the ranks, where the emphasis and focus remains throughout the entire college career on how much maximum strength we can gain or how much speed we can have in a linear fashion. When in fact we need to look at what's contributing to that, how that guy is getting to that speed, how that guy is getting to that strength, and how much it carries over into the sport.
Right.
So eccentric rate of force absorption, a huge one. Control and deceleration is another. And thirdly, just their awareness in regards to how to control their body when we're in space. That once the chaos comes around, because we've done all the cute standard drills that we see in all of our cookbooks of drills, we often don't involve a reactive stimuli in that at the high school and then collegiate level as much as I would like to see it being done. Now, we got to go step by step by step in order to kind of go in what I would refer to as a Mr. Miyagi wax on, wax off type fashion, where you start slow and groove that pattern. But sooner or later in Karate Kid, Mr. Miyagi starts throwing punches because he knows that Danielson's going to get his butt kicked by the Cobra Kai in a bit. So he better become accustomed to being able to have some punches thrown at him. And so I think it's all those things kind of combined together that then show itself in the common compensational patterns that we see happening when someone has to go through force absorption, when they have to widen their base of support, when they have to lower their center of gravity, and they have to do so very, very rapidly.
Right. Well, I think that reactive agility, I mean, you look at some of the research coming out of Australia and whatnot right now, and it's one of the biggest indicators of elite-level athletes, and still has yet to be really tested in any of the battery of tests leading up to selection. You know,
absolutely.
It's something that's going to be definitely on the forefront, I believe.
I would agree wholeheartedly. Yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly. And I think it's time there so we can go from a more pre-programmed nature and having control and competency there to doing so in the most chaotic. You know, that I often talk to my athletes. You know, I made the Ferrari mention once, and I often talk to my athletes that way because, you know, I want them to have the ownership. I want to give them the keys to the Ferrari.
Right.
I don't want to be the driver. I want to be the passenger, the crew chief, and let them be the driver and take ownership of themselves with any movement they do. And whether it's slow and controlled or whether when the most amount of stimuli comes into the mix and a linebacker is bearing down on them in the hole and they right. got to be able to juke them.
Right. No, I agree. You know, when your athletes come in, what does a normal session look like? I mean, is it 60 minutes or 55 minutes of movement and then 5 minutes of strength training, or is it, you know, what's the breakdown?
Well, it really depends on the time of the year, but movement still is always at the forefront of what it is that we do. So it depends on the time of the year, and it depends on how long that guy's been with me, as well as then what I was seeing, whether it's on the field on Sunday just a number of days ago, or whether we're in the off season and what it is that we have for a 2 to 3 specific movement aim. So first and foremost, when a guy comes in, they sit down at my desk or they sit down at my desk and we talk for 5 to 10 minutes and we lay out exactly what it is about that's going to occur. And for me, that's just putting that athlete in the right mindset to change and learn,
right.
to adapt and have the right mindset going in. So it's sometimes if it's a work capacity day, you know, we will be a little rah-rah, but at times I need them to get very focused. I need them to be able to visualize what it is that I need to have them doing. So I might talk about what it is that we did in previous weeks leading up to that, that then is going to show itself in the movement patterns that we're going to go try to get. And so we are able to take a very deliberate intent nature to what it is that we're about to accomplish. Now, I understand that at the college or at the high school level, you don't often have that because you have, you know, tens or dozens of guys with you. But I still think trying to talk to somebody first and tell them exactly what it is that we're trying to accomplish is key to everything else that goes on. So they know exactly why it is that we're going to do what we're going to do rather than just doing it because Sean said so.
Right.
Because I want them, again, to have ownership of the Ferrari. And if they think that Ferrari needs new rims, let's go get them new rims. And so sometimes I give them a choice. Hey, which one would you like to work on? If it's a guy who has a higher level of mastery, I'll say, hey, which one do you want today? You know, I saw this happening on Sunday.
Right.
Do you want to work on A or B? Because I think they'll both help you together. Then from there, we go out. We do, depending on the time of the year, either a general global movement prep or at this time of the year for my NFL guys in the fall, we'll do a very specific game prep. And what some would refer to as a warm-up, I call it movement prep. And that movement prep is specific to that guy and what movement pattern we're going to work on that day.
Okay.
And obviously, you know me, that's kind of a big pet peeve of mine. I'm huge in regards to – I think if every NFL team changed their movement prep to be more specific to the positional demands, we would see performance increase immensely.
Sure.
I believe that there's a reason why there's slow-starting teams and there's fast-starting teams. People say, well, it usually has to do with mentality. Well, sometimes it does, but sometimes I believe that it comes down to the nervous system control, whether it's voluntary or involuntary, conscious or subconscious.
Yeah, that's my next question. It's talking about pregame warm-up, but go ahead and stay with the session.
Perfect. So in the session, then from that movement prep, I'll have those guys work from slow to fast, as I'll probably mention in your question coming up, or my answer to your question coming up. But then as we work up into that, I'm constantly getting feedback. I want them to have an open line of communications with me. Hey, Sean, this is what I'm feeling on this day. This is what I feel in the lunge pattern. This is what I feel when I'm going laterally. This is what I feel when I'm maybe putting the pedal to the floor at a little higher speed. So then that way, I can always tweak and tune what it is that's about to occur later. Now, in the actual session itself, depending on the time of the year, if it's in season, I use a lot of what the Soviets would call conjugate sequencing systems. So where I go from part to whole or from local exercises to global. So I might do 1 to 4 local activities that I believe are going to enhance either the kinetics, the kinematics or the kinesiological pattern, what I would refer to as those things. I'm enhancing some specific aspect. It could be a specialized strength activity. It could be a mental, cognitive, perceptual type game that they're trying to get accustomed to. And then I take that newfound quality that hopefully I've enhanced to a certain degree and then try to put it in a global activity that they need to do that is respective of a similar action and characteristic and pattern that they show on Sunday. So it's a unique kind of way that I go about it, but you know, it's what the Soviets or Verkhoshansky would say, the conjugate sequencing system that he would have used for jumpers or sprinters. I just adopted it to use it for American football players.
Sure.
If it's in the off season, it's those times that were maybe 3 days a week or so where we're just doing nothing but movement, and then other 2 or 3 days we might be working the motor potential. When I say motor potential, it could be anywhere from general motor potential to specific. So strength characteristics, work capacity characteristics, and how it's going to carry over into the movement still at the foundation and at the center. I'm kind of always trying to marry those two things together. Mm-hmm. Technical movement mastery and motor potential or strength and work capacity characteristics, and bridge those together on any given day.
Oh,
wow. So it's not that we put strength, you know, behind us, you know, and then throw that to the wayside. We don't. We just take strength and try to integrate it into the actual movement exactly the way that it's going to be utilized.
Absolutely. Well, that's fantastic. Well, you kind of alluded to it, and this is kind of, you know, this time of year, every Saturday, every Sunday, you watch strength coaches, and everybody's like peeking over their shoulder to see what the other guy's doing for a warm-up,
yeah.
You know, and before the game, because it is. It's one of those things where, you know, you spend all this time doing some prep stuff in the locker room, you do some prep stuff before the game, all of a sudden it's like this obligation to go out there and do this song and dance, stretch, and then, you know, we're off to the races, and mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about if you were to take over the Chicago Bears tomorrow, which is your arch nemesis, but if you were to take over, you know, whatever team, you know, tomorrow, what would the, you know, pregame warm-up look like if you had no outside influence?
Yeah, for me, and this is what I think would then be part of the role of that movement coach. So if I was that movement coach or even the strength and conditioning coach of that given team or even a sports science contributor to that team, this I think is such a huge important topic because for me, it sets the precedence for everything else to come.
Great.
And I think if us as strength and conditioning professionals, sport coaches, et cetera, would take that mentality and realize that everything we do is kind of priming the system for everything that's coming later, that would change our perspective immensely. Because what we realize is that if I have 11 guys on the field at that given moment in time, is all 11 guys don't have the same demands even though they play the same sport. And that's intuitively obvious to any of us.
Right.
So why are we or how are we preparing them in the same ways? You know, we often branch out after their certain degree of warmness or preparedness. We branch them off into their position-specific drills to do a few movements kind of half-heartedly or half-assedly, you know, to a certain degree. But they've done everything prior to that point based on that which we've always done, which often includes a lot of static stretching, and it includes a lot of things that maybe that guy might not need. Mm-hmm. And so in an optimal world for me, I would break down guy by guy and say, okay, we're going to specialize your movement patterns based on that which we know is important. So there's a number of different guidelines that then I would follow, Ron, is we're going from general to specific. So we start general, we move specific. We start slow, we move to faster as time goes on. We start general to specific in regards to the general movement patterns to maybe the more specific thing that guy needs as an individual, but position demands as well.
Right.
And so each and every position, at least at minimum, has their own specific warm-up. We also know that we have different movement trends. Like an offensive lineman moves much differently than a cornerback does.
Right.
It's going to have different compensational patterns globally, holistically speaking, in that offensive tackle versus in that outside corner. And so for me, I'm trying to tailor that movement prep to be as specific as possible to that guy's positional demands and his individual needs. So you watch most of my NFL guys actually doing things. I got a fly buzzing around here. But you watch most of my NFL guys do things. Like I was at training camp, and it's uncanny that I'm sitting there up in the stands, and first one of my guys comes out of the locker room, then a second, then a third, and before you know it, I got 12 of my guys out on the field. They're in an end zone by themselves, no other coaches and no other players are out there, and they're all doing different things.
Right.
And it's kind of crazy to most of them, because now all of a sudden, you know, a head coach that we both know, comes walking out. He's like, wait, what the heck are these guys doing? You know, this guy's doing this lunge pattern. This guy's doing this lateral shuffle and stick and reaccelerate. And, you know, it's kind of fascinating to football coaches because they've never seen it done that way. So by the time the guy gets to the team stretch, he's already warm, he's already prepared, and he's already ready for battle. Right. And I think it's not only physical preparedness in that general movement prep, but it's also psychological. That guy can then build up when he moves from slow to fast or general to specific to where he knows battle's about to ensue.
Right.
Whether for a movement session, a strength and conditioning session, a practice, or obviously ultimately on Saturday and Sunday.
Right.
And we, you know, have guys who have different personalities as well. I have guys who are doing ammonium tablets, and then I have guys who are, like, getting hyped up around the music. Yeah. You know, and it's those types of things. We can tailor that in, individually speaking. But if we were to take every guy and put them in a hip flexor stretch, some of those guys, A, probably don't need to be in that hip flexor stretch biomechanically speaking, or B, that's also just maybe doing more harm than good, where maybe he was already on a high from what he did with listening to his music in the locker room, right, and we've taken him down from that.
Right.
So maybe it would look more disorganized because you got 12 different guys or then 53 different guys or 90 different guys doing different things. But yet at the same time, are we getting the best result is the only thing that Sean Mishka cares about and the only thing that Coach Matt cares about, I think, as well.
Right, sure. Well, I think, you know, I think everybody's making their efforts to try to get to that. You know, it's all the pre-practice stuff, the hurdles and the different, you know, different things, band stretching, foam rolling, all this stuff. Then getting into your slow to fast warm up, and then your static stretch kind of being a, you know, going through the full range and go a definitive start time and those types of things. You know, it's a hard balance, especially when you're dealing with 105 guys, you know,
yeah.
To have that with the organization and the discipline and some of the other things you're trying to instill in a team dynamic, you know, it's a tough question because I think every strength coach would agree with you that, you know, I'd like to do something a little different with this guy and something a little different with this guy, but trying to find a way to coordinate that has been a challenge for myself, and I know others as well.
Yeah, and I don't doubt that it would be a challenge for me, too, if I were to just take over a team, as you're saying, or something of that nature. I think by instilling the right things along the way throughout the year, and obviously you would know better than I would because you have to deal with that 105-plus type guys. But for me, you know, I think it's a constant battle where you just get that guy tailored more and more and more specifically. So we're starting in the off season and we're moving into the season. So they become into what I would refer to as mature sport form where they have that greater ownership. Now,
right,
some guys, of course, at the high school or the collegiate level, we can't give full ownership to because we know that they're not going to do what they're supposed to do. They're not going to show us those habits and behaviors.
Absolutely.
Luckily for me, I have the opportunity because of those National Football League players. They come to me for a specific reason. So if I tell them to run through that wall and that door, they're probably going to do it. But I just have to lead them down that right path. And then I can give them the keys to the Ferrari.
Sure.
I can give them that ownership. And I can then entrust them. And they know that Sean's in the crowd. And if I'm not doing exactly what I need to be doing, well, damn it, I'm going to hear about it afterwards. And nobody wants to hear about it from me. So they just want nice little text messages or nice little talks afterwards. So,
well,
you know, I know that I can give them or entrust them with a little greater ownership, and I think we'd probably see that if we're talking about the higher levels of qualification
right.
in the NFL and the NBA and the NHL, those types of sports, we can entrust or hopefully entrust those athletes with more specific movement preparation and warm-up demands.
Right.
And just try to make it maybe more global to your specific application or that high school and other college programs.
Right, and I think that's what everybody's trying to do. And, you know, I would, you know, you mentioned it earlier and mentioned it again there, but, you know, a lot of people would ask me all the time what the biggest difference between NFL and college is, or because I've gone back and forth, and you know, it's a more informed consumer is what I always say, you know, and
yeah.
you know they you know it's their job, it's the approach that they take, and so they're a little bit more open to it, not always, but a little bit more open to coaching, but you know, but when you're talking about sitting them down for that 5 to 10 minutes. You know, what I've done is I've adopted that to be on the whiteboard, you know, and at the first
Absolutely.
5 to 10 minutes is on the whiteboard in the weight room, and this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it. And if we introduce a new movement, we're coaching it to the entire group so that they all see why we're doing it and what the pitfalls of not doing it the correct way would be. You know, and so if your knee's shooting past your toe, then you know that's patellar tendonitis, and that's all, you know, all the things that are going to lead to you not being on the field.
I love that. And I see so few people doing that, which seems so intuitively obvious. It seems so easy to be able to take a few minutes, explain why, because anytime anyone understands why, they're likely to do it in the how, or at least to the greatest of their ability, they're going to do the how, as to what we instructed, if they believe and entrust in the fact that, hey, this is important, and here's why.
Sure. No, I agree 100%. Well, man, I know you need to get going, and so do I. But you know, we always end the show with some resources here. So give me a quote that you live by or you have plastered up somewhere.
Yeah, you know, I'll give you two of them, and I'm going to look right behind my computer here. The first one is from someone in our field, someone who I've had an opportunity to learn from, Dr. Yuri Verkhoshansky's daughter, Natalia. I had the opportunity to I used to be an adjunct professor at a local university here for a 5-year period of time, and I had her guest speak via webcam on a number of cases. And to my last undergrad class, she said, sport is the art of movement. And the purpose of our job then is the improvement of that movement. And for me, that's plastered on my wall right behind me on my computer here. And it's something that I live by. I have it on my computer here. I have it on my desk at home. So anytime I'm designing programs, anytime I'm watching film, I always go back to, yeah, Sean, you may want to make that guy stronger and bigger and faster and so on and so forth, but how is it going to impact the movement?
Right.
You know, and I know we've kind of exhausted that topic and that idea so far here over the last, you know, 45, 50 minutes. The other one that I live by is by someone not in our field, but I believe that professionals in our field, in order to continue to grow, have to continue to kind of come to this realization. I've read a lot and have researched a lot of Steve Jobs from Apple. And so he said, don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. And most importantly, have the courage to follow your own heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become, and everything else is just secondary. So for me, I also have that plastered on the wall right behind me. So for me, at the end of the day, when someone wants to fit me into a certain mold, I just have to ask myself, hey, does that compromise who I want to be as a professional and at my craft or not, or as a person and a human? So I think those are two quotes that I live by on a day-to-day basis or attempt to that I think we all could probably benefit.
Yeah, those are fantastic ones. What about, you know, give us a couple book, app, and website recommendations.
Yeah, a couple books. I just got them sitting next to me, actually, by chance. So the first one, Yuri Verkhoshansky, Natalia Verkhoshansky. Okay, Special Strength Training Manual for Coaches, written a couple of years ago. It takes a lot of the Soviet methods and ideas, takes a lot of them for track and field, but then I've kind of adopted them and applied them. And from a movement science standpoint, for American football, obviously my sport training Bible is a good old Super Training. I actually used this in that undergrad course that I talked about, earlier, by Mel Siff and Yuri Verkhoshansky, late and great sports scientists in our field. And then finally a new one. And I know that you had, Joyce on a couple of weeks back, but here, the High Performance Training for Sports, those are three that I really like. I would recommend to every professional in our field. As far as apps, I would say any video sport movement analysis app you can find, whether it's Kinesio and Capture and Spark Motion, whether it's Dartfish, whether it's Ubersense, any of those. Any or all of them that will allow you to investigate. And what I think on that front, what we need to get to, as you could probably speculate, is we have a lot of professionals in our field investigating the movement and strength and conditioning. So they'll look at the squat or they'll look at a hand clean and they'll tape that and make technical changes to it. But what about the movement?
Absolutely.
And look at the movement. It makes it a quick, easy way to whip out my iPad, show that guy what he's doing in acceleration or deacceleration so he knows if his heel is hitting and he's taking too big a stride. We got to shorten that up, and he has an immediate reference point on what he can change kinesthetically.
Absolutely. What about a website? We're going to link up your websites, obviously, but what's another website?
Yeah, you know, my websites are obviously good places to go, but I would also say one that I frequent a lot is the International Society of Biomechanics and Sport.
Okay.
You know, I know a lot of that kind of bridges some things for me. It bridges a lot of the things that we talked about. Movement in the biomechanics as it takes place in sport, and then the strength characteristics and the marriage of those things. So motor potential, technical mastery, what exactly we need to look at technically, and how it is that we need to go about changing it. So I really like that, and I really like some of the stuff in the papers that they put out, as well as some of the directions that society kind of goes with things and tries to really look at sport biomechanics and not just biomechanics generally and globally speaking.
No, that's great. That's great. Well, and you, one last one here, and this is something I want to start adding, but what's the best piece of coaching advice you've ever received?
Yeah, you know, ironically, I already mentioned Natalia Verkhoshansky, but in that same, presentation, and she talked to one of my undergrad classes for about 3 hours, so I'm very humbled and gracious by that. That was very gracious of her. But in that talk, she made the mention, because everyone kept asking her, being a sports scientist and her with her sports science background based on who her father is, kept asking her science-related questions. And finally she said, "Listen, guys and gals, I want to stop you and I want to remind you that as a coach, this is more of an art than it is a science." And a light bulb went off. Not only I could see across my entire, 25 kids in that class, but ironically enough, it went off in my brain as well. And this was a number of years back, I would say about 3 or 4 years ago now, when she said that. And it just hit home to me that it is still, at the end of the day, about making sure that we take the best art and blend of everything.
That's right.
And that's going to be dependent on what canvas you have, whether it's Eastern Michigan University or whether it's Explosive Edge Athletics or whether I get hired by one of 32 teams down the road.
Right.
So it's all about making sure that nothing is the gospel, but assuring that everything kind of goes along according to your path and your plan that works the best, so you paint the best possible picture for you, your situation, and obviously your athlete performance when and where it counts.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Well, Sean, buddy, like I said, man, you've been a good friend to me through the years, and obviously very gracious with your time. But one of the reasons why I do this show and I enjoy it so much is because as strength coaches, we're so territorial sometimes as to we don't like the trainers, we don't like the nutritionists, we don't like the performance specialists, and all these things. And there's so many brilliant people out there, yourself and others, that we need to continue to network and learn and continually strive to make each other better. And you and I have had that relationship since we met, and I appreciate that about you, man. And for a guy that's as successful as you are, to always be giving back and putting materials out there and things like that, says a lot about your character and the person that you are. So I appreciate what you do on a daily basis, man.
Well, I appreciate it, vice versa. And I think, the things that I always point my young professionals that come to me, try to use me as a mentor into the directions that you do as well, for the very same reasons. I actually talked to Mr. Raymond about that just the other day, and how much I respect what it is that you do and the integrity that you give to the profession because of that. Because I agree with you wholeheartedly. We shouldn't be as territorial as we are. If we're more willing to give with our time, our knowledge, our expertise, someone else is going to pay it forward and do the same. And if we can all do that, I think all of us are going to benefit, as are our athletes, which are the ones that we're entrusted with improving their performance and who they are as human beings as well.
No, well said, man. Well, have a great week, buddy.
You got it, my friend. Same to you.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, EliteForm.com and IgnitionAPG.com, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out RonMcKeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @RMcKeefrey, on Facebook and YouTube at @Ron.McKeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.